At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
It's the Son of a Butch podcast. You guys know the drill. We come to you every Wednesday. But this week, it's a special occasion for the pod. We just went over 2 million downloads, and I can't thank all of you who listen each and every week for making that happen. I'm still blown away that I do a podcast and we've got 2 million downloads. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling to me. But the support, and when I'm on the road and when I see people at tournaments, they'll come up and say, hey, I'm big fan of the pod. So thank each and every one of you for listening. And given that it's a big week for the pod, I figured we'd get a big guest on. Victor Hovland is our guest this week. World number 4, the reigning FedEx Cup champion. And I think Vic's easily one of the top 5 best players in the game of golf. He has big time game. I think there are majors in his future. I think there are multiple majors possibly in his future. I think he is going to be around for a very, very long time. And it was incredibly cool for me to be able to sit down and talk to him and kind of pick his brain about the way he plays, about how he goes about playing. I love Vic's attitude. He's always smiling. He's always laughing. We talk about the Ryder Cup. We talk about, you know, where golf is, professional golf is in 2024. But really, I think if you get an opportunity to sit down and talk to a player who, like I said, I think he's one of the best players in the game, and I think he can beat anybody on any kind of golf course. That's how good he is. So a very, very cool interview with Vic that's coming up. But before we get to that interview, let's take a moment to thank our friends at Cobra Golf and talk about their new driver for 2024. You've heard me talk about it. Cobra has their new Dark Speed driver, which is a perfect combination of groundbreaking aerodynamics, precision PWR bridge weighting, and AI-designed hot face technology that delivers transcendent speed. I love it. I was talking to a couple players today that have put it in the bag. They really like it. And if you're looking for a new driver, go to CobraGolf.com and check out the Dark Speed offers that they've got. They've got a game improvement one. They've got a kind of a middle of the road one. And then they have, like all manufacturers, they've got their better player one. But the Cobra Dark Speed is a legit driver. If you're looking for more distance, more speed with more forgiveness, go to CobraGolf.com and check it out. So now let's get to a very, very cool interview with, like I said, he's one of the best players in the game. He's a fan favorite, and big things are going to continue to happen to Victor Hovland. Take a listen. Vic, you had a unbelievable year in 2023. I think the stat that jumps out, no missed cuts. How have you managed since you've turned pro? I mean, you've really become one of the most consistent golfers in the sport. Is it something that you're conscious of? Is it something that you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I value consistency a lot. Obviously you want to win tournaments, and I think professional golf really tailors to the times you play your best, and that's when you got to make the most out of it. But I think it's just a lot less stressful if I show up every week just knowing that, okay, my game's in a good spot. And I think the fact that my short game improved so much last year, now I didn't even have to hit it my best, and I could still kind of make nice up and downs and just keep momentum going. Before, I would not miss very many cuts just because my ball striking was so consistent, but I still kind of had a little asterisk there with the short game. But now I feel like my ball striking hasn't been quite as good, but my short game has kind of made up for that and then some. So I just think making better decisions, not playing maybe as risky as I did when I first came out on tour, just knowing when to push and when to not push, I think I'm making a lot less mistakes you know, just simple mistakes, short sighting, missing long on a green where you can't, stuff like that. So I really value not missing cuts and playing four rounds. I do prefer that.
That it's an art to learning on tour when to play offense, when you need to play offense, and when to play defense, when you need to play defense. I think you mentioned you came out as a rookie. You can get into that trap of saying, okay, I've made a double. I've made a couple bogeys. Okay, now I need to go on offense. But sometimes the golf course that you're playing doesn't allow you, or isn't really, it's not the right play. So you said you learned that, you know, you've been on tour now 3-4 years. You're learning how to play. But when you come out on tour, when did you kind of figure out, okay, what I could get away with maybe in the past in making some dicey decisions, or maybe making some really, really aggressive decisions at the level that I'm playing at right now, professional golf, it just doesn't allow me to do that. When was that kind of light bulb moment where you went, okay, if I can start maybe just being a little bit more conservative? Because I think, Vic, the opposite is what everyone thinks. Everyone watching professional golf and everyone trying to get to the level that you're at thinks that you all are getting there by just being firing at every flag, going for every pin, going for every par 5 and 2. And there really is an art to playing professional golf. It's just not your golf swing.
Yeah, and I definitely had to learn it the hard way. I think some of it is, sometimes I'll still play offensive or aggressive just because, like, I want to. I think it's fun. But there is, like, I've gotten into poker a little bit. So knowing the numbers and the just the likelihood.
And the percentages. The percentages. What the game is. Because the game, poker, it's interesting that I'd heard that you had gotten really big into poker. I used to teach, when I lived in Vegas back in the day, I used to teach Huckleberry Seed. Huck Seed won the World Poker Championship, and he was like a savant. He was trying to play golf and stuff like that. So the idea of playing poker, how do you think playing poker helps you on the golf course? Do you think that's been one of the things where you've gone, okay, do I really need to make this play right now? Or I'm going to get my par 5 chances with my length. There are some pins that I can attack maybe on the back nine, but that's a hard thing to learn, and it's a hard thing to learn in the time frame that you've learned it, I think.
Yeah, I'd say it's kind of a double-edged sword, because sometimes there is a value to being kind of young and dumb, having no scar tissue, and just, I'm just going to hit driver everywhere. I hit it straight, so why not just hit it here, even though mathematically it might not be a great play in the long term. But sometimes just not even being aware of that or putting those thoughts into your head, you have this just overconfidence, and you know that, okay, I'm a straight hitter with a driver, so I'm just going to hit it everywhere. And it most of the time it worked. But then when you start delving deeper into the stats, and Eduardo Molinari that I work with, he's my stats guy. He's really helped me just kind of put things into perspective a little bit more. And but I did kind of struggle a little bit when I didn't feel like my swing was quite where it should be at the time. When you start thinking about the percentages and you're like, okay, it's kind of a 50-50 play, I could hit driver or 3-wood, and then you maybe kind of start to second guess things a little bit. There's a little bit of doubt that creeps into the decision making, and that is something that you don't really take into account when you're just purely looking at the mathematics. So it's like, if it's a really close decision, I try to just let my emotions and my feels trump the decision. But if it's like a 70-30 or 65-35, then, you know, things are pretty clear cut as what you're supposed to do. I think just in whole, it's the more information you have, the better a decision you can make. And I think that's just good to know.
And see, obviously, I work with two guys, you know, Brooks and DJ, to where they're the opposite. They want as little information as possible so that they can kind of react and be an athlete. Your caddy, Shay Knight, who I think is one of the best guys on tour, he's someone that, you know, I've always enjoyed spending time with. And I don't know if you know the story, but he came up to me at Memorial when you were getting ready to turn pro, and he said, "Hey, man, can I talk to you?" Because I used to spend a lot of time with Shea because he caddied for Sean O'Hare and Jimmy Walker, who I used to work with. My dad and I, they played a ton of practice rounds. So I spent a lot of time around Shea, and Shea said, "Listen, can I talk to you? We're at Memorial." And he said, "Victor Hovland is going to turn pro. He's asked me if I want to work with him." I worked with him at, you know, in a couple of the majors, and he said, you know, "What do you think?" And I was just like, "Dude, it's the kid's a stud. It's a huge opportunity." And he was like, "Do you really think he's going to be, you know, a great player?" I said, "Listen, he's top five in the world, good." And so that partnership with Shea, when you guys are looking at golf courses, because we get asked that so much, Vic, from players trying to play, when you guys are going into practice rounds and you're looking at golf tournaments, and the majors, it becomes more heightened. But what are the things that you and Shea are looking at? What are the things that you're looking at when you look at a golf course and you say, okay, even if you played that golf course before, you're going out there in the practice rounds, and the conversations between you and Shea are, okay, obviously what we're going to hit off the tee, what we're, but how do you all approach kind of charting around a golf? Do you do that as much as he does, or does he kind of shepherd you around? He does the work and say, "Hey, I think this is the play," and then you kind of, as the player, either listen or don't.
Yeah, he's a very, like, I consider him a really good friend of mine, but he's also very, very professional. He goes out there early and walks the course, and he does a very, just puts a lot of work in to prepare. So when I play my first practice round, he's already seen the course and he knows kind of where I need to be, what clubs to hit. And then it just becomes a discussion of, okay, I think the conditions are going to be this in the tournament. They're maybe going to get a little firmer, or it might get wetter because of the rain that's coming. Wind might switch. And then certain pin placements, like it might be a short par four where we're going to hit a driver. But if the wind switches, it goes to downwind, they put a front pin. Now we can't get the wedge to stop, so we need to hit less off the tee. You know, just simple things like that. And then I might have some stats from Eduardo if we've played the course before. Okay, these pin placements generally play a little bit easier if you hit driver or three wood off the tee. It all depends. So having a lot of that information even before you go into a practice round is really valuable, I think. And then he might say, "Hey, I think this is the better play, but whatever I feel at the time," then that's sort of going to trump it. But we're always having a discussion and trying to manage the game plan accordingly to what's the best play.
When you look at golf courses, Vic, on tour, obviously you play a bunch of golf courses over the course of the year. There's going to be courses that you like. But for a golf course that you play that you like, what does that mean? From when you look at a golf course, you say, "Okay, I've played this golf course. I really like that golf course." Give me an example of a golf course on tour that you really, really like, and give me some reasons and examples as to why you like that golf course.
Yeah, just got back from Riviera. I really like that golf course.
Great golf course.
And I tend to play pretty well in Florida, so Florida golf courses tend to fit me very well. And I think generally that's because I'm a good ball striker off the tee. I hit my driver pretty straight, so I'm gonna gain an advantage because now I do think I have an advantage at Riviera because you still got to hit it pretty well out there, but there aren't any penalty shots out there now.
Yeah, there's no water, and you've got to hit it miles offline on that stretch
to hit it out of
bounds.
Yeah,
you know, on the back nine there's that stretch where you can hit out of bounds left, and on the front nine if you really rinse one to the right, I mean, but you've got to hit really, you're
really
right. I've never
shots.
Thought about that. There's no hazards at Riviera, which is very, very rare.
Yeah.
The only time you really see that nowadays is if we go to the Open Championship and you play one of the inland, you know, where there's just no water.
Yeah.
It might be a couple of streams. You know, St. Andrews has the stream that goes across the first. But a lot of the Open Championship golf course, you're right, there's no hazards.
Yeah.
So a golf course with no hazards, it's a different kind of look and feel.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I think, like, Riviera is just it's one plot of land that they can't really expand it anymore. And it's been around for so long, and you still make that golf course as tough as it is with no penalty shots. That's impressive. And it's not stupid. You know, it's fair. If you play well, you're going to shoot a good score. If you're missing fairways and missing greens, you're going to have a hard time. So I like just straightforward, fair golf courses. Now, Florida golf courses are a little bit different because you have some water. You generally have some OB kind of closer to the course. But that's where I think I have an advantage because if I'm hitting fairway more often than the other guys that I'm playing against, they're going to be more heavily penalized by missing the fairway. So I have an advantage there. And generally when the greens get firm, I can, you know, just the value of hitting greens go up. And yeah, especially if I'm hitting it nicely, I'm going to be able to separate myself there. But I think that's generally the case for the bigger tournaments, you know, majors. If you go to Memorial, for example, they're going to have kind of that style of golf. It's going to be long. It's going to be narrow-ish fairways and thick rough. So if you can hit it long and straight and hit greens, that's usually a pretty good recipe.
So Vic, the obvious question for everyone listening is, what's it like to be able to stand up and have the confidence? Because that is this, that is one of the strengths of your game, is the ability to drive it as well as you drive it, to not really, you don't really curve your golf ball enough. I mean, a lot. So that must, it, the look of a hole for someone like yourself that has so much confidence with the driver has got to be very different from someone that doesn't have a lot of confidence, because there's, you know, there's parts of, you know, if you think of you won it at East Lake, but there's some holes there to where, you know, like that, like what is it, after the par three on the back, was at 15, you know, that if it kind of that dog leg up there in the corner, but if you've got the confidence to say, listen, okay, I'm going to fly the bunkers and I'm going to get it up into that neck, and it's maybe a little bit flatter there. When you have the confidence that you have in the driver, you're able to say, okay, I know if I can get it in that area, maybe it's a little bit flatter than it is here. If I don't hit it as far, it must mentally, it must give you a tremendous amount of confidence going into tournaments, because the driver is a weapon, and you as the player know it is.
Yeah, I will say the last few months I haven't swung it as well as I would like. And the ball's been going two ways a little bit. And just from experience, it's a lot more stressful playing golf when you don't know exactly where the ball's going to go. Now, nobody knows exactly where the ball's going to go. But I would say when I play my best golf,
it's driven it on a string.
Yeah. And it's so liberating, especially when you get to those tighter holes. Like, let's say there's water down the left side, and I can just aim it kind of down the left side and just pump one and fade it off of it. And it's not like I'm hitting a weak slice over there. It's still a powerful just cut off the water. And I know when I hit that shot, when I get nervous, I just play a slightly bigger cut. The ball's almost never going to go left. Now, it might be in the right side of the fairway, might be in the middle of the fairway, right rough, but it's never going left. As I'm getting ready to play Bay Hill now in a couple weeks, I just think of, for example, number 11 out there, if you remember that hole. You got water down the left side.
So you can just stand up and know that, okay, left is out of play.
Yeah.
And it also, I think it allows you to then, and it's the same thing we're always trying to tell people that play, to make a conservative, aggressive swing. Not reckless. There's a difference between being reckless with the driver and saying, listen, I drive it well, so I can be aggressive. I can still be a conservative off the tee, but I can make a conservative, committed swing here. So that 11th hole at Bay Hill, water all the way down the left-hand side, you've got the confidence to stand up and say, listen, I know it's not going to go left. I can make a really committed swing and just stand up and rip it.
Yeah. Whereas a lot of guys I've seen hit 4 irons, 3 irons, hybrids, three woods. Yeah, and then they have, yeah, you got more room, so you're probably going to hit it in the water less, but now you got 7, 6 iron, maybe even 5 iron into that green, and those pins on the left side are, I mean, it's almost impossible to get to it when you're hitting that long of a club. Whereas if I'm really confident with my driver, and I think most of the time I think I've hit that fairway a lot, and then I have a 50-degree, maybe a pitching wedge at max into that green, and now you turn a hard hole into a birdie hole. So just doing that consistently, especially around a place like that, you turn a beast of a course into a place where, okay, if I make a few putts and play nicely, I can shoot 5-6 under. And yeah, that place has treated me pretty nicely over the years.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
There are players that dominate through power, physical speed. You're not someone that people look at and go, okay, he's a killer. He's dominant. But do you feel like the ability to hit the driver the way you have pretty much your whole career is also kind of a differentiator down the stretch when you're playing with someone, you guys are in a big tournament, you guys are kind of tied for the lead and stuff. There get to be tight holes where you have the confidence to say, listen, I'm pulling the chief. I'm taking the head cover off. I'm pulling driver. If you're hitting first and it's back nine on Sunday, that's also kind of a differentiator, kind of a separator to say to the guy you're playing with, listen, we might be tied, but you've got the iron out and I'm just going to go ahead here and hit driver. Do you feel that's a way to quietly intimidate the other players by saying, listen, you know I'm going to hit driver here. Yeah. I'm a good driver of the golf ball. If you're going to give up 40, 50 yards here because you don't feel like you can drive it down there. Another one, 17 at the Tour Championship. If you've got the confidence to just start it over the bunkers, hammer the driver down there, you get it much, much closer. Because if you don't have the confidence on that hole and you're going to take 3 wood or an iron off the tee, you miss it a little. You'd be on a little bit of an upslope and not. But if you've got the confidence, like you said, to just take it over the bunkers on 17 at East Lake and get it down there, down the stretch, that's got to be a differentiator to where you're saying somebody that you're playing with, hey, you're gonna have to come get me.
Until you double cross it and you're behind a tree. But most of the time it's like I'm pulling the driver because I feel confident and I know it's the right play, and more often than not I'm gonna hit, you know, my misses aren't as bad to where I'm gonna make a huge mistake. Now I might end up in the right rough, but how much am I really losing compared to the guy that's pulling iron or 3 wood and he's 60 yards behind me? It's like there's not that big of a difference. I still might be ahead from the right rough because I'm hitting a gap wedge in there. So I feel like that's, if I've driven it really well generally and that week, I think the other player knows that, okay, he's hitting driver and he's probably not going to give it away. If I was playing against a guy that's a sprayer, and he pulls driver, I might go, oh, okay, let's see where this one ends up, you know? And then I might hit 3 wood or something less, to depending on where he hits his shot. But I'd at least like to think that when I pull driver, the other guy's thinking, okay,
he's gonna hit the fairway.
He's probably going to hit a pretty nice shot, and he's going to set up a birdie or at least a par. So I now need to make a birdie to beat him or to tie him. It's not like, he's going to give it away now. So I might do it somewhere else, but not off the tee.
You mentioned, we've been talking about something that you have tremendous confidence in, your driver. By your own admission, when you turned pro, the short game was, I mean, it was a liability. And it wasn't, it was something that everybody could see. You could see it. You had, even when you won in Puerto Rico, you laid the sod over one, a pretty easy one.
Two in a row.
How nervous when you... Before you last year, the work you did with Joe Mayo, the chipping and stuff. But before that, how nervous is, as one of the best players in the world, would you get over a chip shot? And what were the ones, Vic, that made you the most? Were they the easy ones that made you the most nervous, or were the tough ones?
Well, it's like I knew I didn't have a great short game, but in college I thought it was okay.
Turn pro, and you realize how bad your short game is.
Yeah, pretty much. Real quick. Yeah, but I never had like the yips, or I'm like, oh my god, I don't know how this is gonna go. It was just like, this is a hard shot. It's into the grain. So usually, when I was into the grain and I had to elevate it and stop it quickly, I'm like, okay, this is impossible. You know,
so unless you hit the flop.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you're bringing danger and double bogey into play.
Yeah, so I'd be like, okay, well, my reasoning was, and I would tell the guys on the team, it's like, yeah, that was a bad chip, but it was bad that I even ended up here. So I'm just going to go to the range instead and figure this out, you know? And
so your mentality was a lot like a lot of junior golfers.
Yeah.
And I'll just basically, I'm bad at this, so I'll just go make what I'm good at even better.
Yeah.
The problem is, I think that works up until a certain level.
Yeah.
Until you get on tour and then you see the short games of the guys like Patrick Reed, of the guys, of the wedge players, guys like Jason Day, the really, really classy, I mean, Jordan Spieth's short games,
pretty filthy
around the greens. JT's become a great wedge player. So what did you learn and what has been the fix that, that has really helped you? Because, I mean, I'm watching you on the second group out at the Ryder Cup. You chip one in from 50 feet. I'm down on the first hole. We hear the roar. I'm like, I guarantee you Vic's chipped this in. And then they showed it on the screen. You chipped in 50 footer. But that was a shot 2 years ago. You didn't know how to hit.
No.
From that position. So everybody, if you haven't seen it, you can go back. But okay. You've missed the green. You're just off the green on the first hole at Marco Simone. It's like 50 feet. You've got to go over some rough. And then it's a little bit down the slope. You've got to stop it. Like I said, 2-3 years ago, you didn't have that shot. So before, in that situation, what would you have been trying to do? And I guarantee you, in the situation that you were in, you're like, I can make this.
Yeah.
So what would you have been thinking before over a chip shot like the one on the first hole at the Ryder Cup? You and Ludwig, your second group out. It's early. You guys know you can set the tone. In the past, what type of shot would you have hit and what type of shot did you hit when you hooped it?
Yeah. I mean, I would have grabbed the putter right away. And I, to be honest, I think most guys would have pulled putter there. I don't think it's a bad play. Because I think consistently you're probably going to hit it to 10 feet. And I would have just given Ludwig the 10-footer for par there. But I just saw it, okay, if I can chip this, hit a low kind of bump into the slope that I had in front of me, and then check, it was going to have less speed going down the hill than it would if I putted it. So I figured, okay, if I chip it and hit a good shot, now I can suddenly hit it. You know, I can maybe stop it close to the hole. And as it came off the face, it did exactly what I wanted it to do. Came out a little low, skipped, and checked.
When did you know it was... When did you think you'd made it?
Well, as it was going down the hill, I thought it was a pretty nice shot. I'm like, okay, this could be good. And then it kept breaking. And I wasn't even thinking. I just reacted to it. And I started walking when it was probably... 6, 7, 8, 9 feet out, and when it went in, it was it was just like, wow, what just happened?
There are roars in golf. There are roars at majors. You know, there's a Tiger roar. You know when Tiger's doing something. Yeah. You kind of know when Rory's on the course and he's starting to go. You can hear it. But then there are roars in the Ryder Cup, and then there are the noise the crowd makes when you're playing in Europe as a European. The sound was unbelievable. Yeah. And then the sound from the first tee where everybody went nuts too.
Yeah.
The Ryder Cup, your first one was at Whistling Straits. It wasn't great for the European side. You didn't win any of your matches. You go 3-1-1 at Marco Simone. What was the difference and how were those experiences different for you?
Yeah, obviously being a rookie in Whistling Straits, it was tough. We didn't have any European fans there because of COVID, and being in the United States, it was definitely a daunting task. And I think because I had some holes in my game, meaning the short game, my ball striking was very good that week. But you're just not gonna win.
You're gonna miss greens.
Yeah, you're gonna miss greens, and you're just not gonna win matches in four balls or even four sums if you're not making putts and making easy up and downs. And I think when you're just in that setting where your anxiety or you're super nervous in that moment and you have holes in your game that there's nowhere to hide. I think you're just going into an event like that not as confident, or you're not the best version of yourself. And I think at Marco Simone, I just won the FedEx Cup. Yeah,
three times. Yeah. You've had an unbelievable year. So the confidence level going in.
Yeah.
And also, different. Vic, you know a little bit more what to expect. For everyone listening, everybody talks about the Ryder Cup, the pressure. But just as a coach, it's heightened. You can feel it. You can feel that it's different. You as a player, when you got into the first Ryder Cup at Whistling Straits, when did you kind of go, okay, wow, this is different? I mean, and it is a different type of pressure too, because normally you're just playing for yourself. All of a sudden, you know, for the first couple of days, you've got a partner now and you've got to think about, I don't want to leave this guy 10 feet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So the first year versus the second year, it is a little bit more, okay, I know a little bit more of what to expect. I thought that Hazeltine was going to be the breakout for you. I just thought everything you'd done up to that point, I was like, this is going to be kind of the coming out for you, because we see that every 2 years, there's someone in a Ryder Cup that steps up and everybody goes, wow, we look at him differently now. I think the performance you had in Rome this year has been that moment for you. You were one of the guys that were, it was you, it was Rory, it was Tommy, but you were one of the guys that John Rahm was one. You were, every team has those 4 to 3 guys that everybody on the team knows that they expect points from.
Yep.
The media, the press, and everything. Was it somewhat liberating and freeing you going into Marco Simone going, okay, I'm top 3 in the world right now. There are no real better players in the world than me. We're playing in Europe now. Now I can kind of almost kind of show off how good I am, as opposed to go, okay, let me just kind of see how this week goes.
Yeah, it was more, as you explained, like, because of that confidence, I'm stepping up on that first D and thinking, instead of, oh, I better not mess up or just try to make a decent swing at it, don't do this, don't do that. It's more like, okay, let's enjoy this and let's show off kind of the things that I've been working on this year, and let me prove myself the level of play that I can show, and I'm going to do it right now. So it was more just like, I was so much more at ease. I was confident. I was enjoying the moment a lot more. Whereas as Whistling Straits, I knew I had some holes in there, and all the people that are there are rooting for you to mess up. So it's like, it's just tough to get over that. It's not impossible, because I think some guys really like that pressure, but you've got to have the foundations to back that up. You can't just be, okay, I'm going to show you and really believe it, if you don't have the skill sets to back it up. And I just didn't think I had it at the time. So that was really nice to kind of prove that in Rome this summer.
You played 2 of the matches with Ludvig Åberg. How good do you think this kid can be? Because I mean, I watched a lot of his match. I was doing some TV, and then he played Brooks on Sunday. And even though Brooks, you know, beat him, he has a toolbox that looks fairly full in what he can and can't do.
Yeah, we talked about driving earlier on in the talk here, and yeah, he's like, he hits it pretty far, hits it pretty high, and just does the same thing on repeat, it seemed like. I haven't played with him that much since, but in Rome it was, yeah, even in the practice rounds,
he didn't seem nervous at all.
No, he didn't, and that's what's it's pretty impressive and pretty cool to watch. But at the same time, you can still see that there's, and I don't mean this disrespective, but like, he's got clear improvements in his game.
Peter Hansen, who's his coach, who played on the European Tour for a long time, played in a Ryder Cup. He was at the Ryder Cup, the Miracle at Medina.
Yeah.
He was walking the last round where Brooks was playing Ludvig, and we were walking inside the ropes, and he was like, listen, man, this kid has a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And you're watching him and you're seeing how much success he's had that week. But I think that just goes to show that for someone like you, you know how good you have to be. You know how consistent you have to be. And you yourself have turned pro knowing that you had some holes in your game, which you fixed. And, you know, what are the, I guess, how does he go about getting better? And I think everybody's trying to get better. How do you go about getting better as a player and say, okay, I've got to try and improve this part, but it can't take away from things that have made me get here and made me a dominant player?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to kind of evaluate his game when I haven't seen it. You need a bigger sample size to really tell.
At the end of this year, I think we'll get a better idea of where we think he's going to be in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. But I'd say playing with him in the Ryder Cup, now the greens were a little bit slower in Marco Simone. But I'd say, you know, when you were a little bit nervous and those lag putts, the speed probably needs to get a little bit better. And there's probably some like decision-making stuff, kind of like what I did when I first came out on tour. I'm firing at some pins and don't really know what side to miss it on. And I would miss it on some sides that are just death.
You can't make, you're getting over to that situation. And yeah. You're like, I cannot make bogey from here.
Yeah, exactly. And we're all going to hit bad shots. And hitting bad shots is fine, but there's some places where you can't hit a bad shot and miss it there, you know? So,
because you're going to struggle to make a bogey.
Exactly. Whereas, like, there's some, and that's one of the things that I think I improved on a lot last year. I would have nice tournaments where for 9 holes straight, it didn't feel like I hit a single good shot. But I would still get around and even par, 1 under par, because I just missed in the right spots. I would make an easy up and down, and then maybe on a par 5, I would wedge it close and make the putt.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only, must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
With your type of game, Vic, with the weapon you have with the driver, how straight you can hit the driver, how far you can hit the driver, and ball striking is one of your calling cards, you know now that, okay, I don't necessarily have to play that. I mean, is it that? You realize now, I don't have to play that great all the time.
Yeah.
If I can just tread water, I've got my par fives that I can take advantage of. And over 4 days, I'm going to have a day where if my ball striking is the way it normally is, I'm going to have that day. And you do that. That's one of the things I love about your game is you are... Every single week, you're going to have that round where it's like, it's almost like you can bank on it. You're going to shoot 65 one of the days of the 3 days. And one of the things I really like about your game, Vic, and I think one of the reasons why you've been so consistent is you have that Saturday round where you're not afraid to go, okay, let me go shoot 64 on Saturday now and get myself into one of these. You do it a lot, and I don't think that is not normal for rookies and guys that are this new. You have that knack on Saturday to be one of those guys that just goes, okay, you know, I'm going to shoot 64, 66 on the weekend and see where it goes. That's an art, and that's something that not a lot of players can do all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing you're touching on there, because I definitely – would psych myself out a little bit when I first came out, is that you have an afternoon tee time and then you see Thursday morning some guy posts 64 and now the wind starts blowing in the afternoon and you're like, man, I'm 1 under par. I'm kind of playing nice. I'm not making too many putts, but I'm 7 shots back. So instead of before...
And then you can press.
Yeah. And then you short-sighted yourself and you make a dumb bogey you would never make. And now you're 8 shots back. And it's like, this is a 72-hole tournament. The chances of this guy shooting 64 the first round, the chances of him winning maybe on Sunday is, you know, not as high as you would think.
And if he shoots 4 rounds in the 60s, you say, hey, good play. It was your week. You shoot 4 rounds in the 60s around here, you're probably going to win.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the mindset then turned into, especially when I was playing better and just getting more experience. It's funny how you think better when you play better.
It helps.
It helps. But
isn't that interesting, Vic, that when you're playing, and you're not the first player that has ever said that, when you're playing bad, your decision-making process is always terrible, right? It's very rarely when you're playing bad are you making really good, smart, clear, focused decisions on the golf course. And when you are playing great and you have a chance to win tournaments when the pressure is the most, it seems to me as an outsider looking in, that's when I've watched some of the players I've been lucky enough to work with. It's like when the mindset is the clearest and the decision-making process is the best. And you would think that it would just be so, obviously, let me just think good when I'm playing bad and it'll just solve everything. But it's hard to do that, right?
Yeah, I think it's just, I think a lot of it comes back to just the confidence that you have inside. It's like, you know that, oh, I just double-crossed this driver and I'm making a double bogey here. That's going to piss you off more than if you're playing sweep, because you know you can make that ground up. So you're going to handle the bad shot a lot better, and you're going to make better decisions because you know it's the right play, and you know that, okay, I'm playing nice. The right play to this hole is not to go at the pin. I need to hit it to 30 feet, and then par is a good score, and I can actually make that 30-footer sometimes. If you're, if you have momentum, you feel good, you have good speed on the greens, you can make that 30-footer. You turn that into a birdie, and now it's just game on. Whereas you make that double bogey, now you're pissed off. The next hole, you know it's middle of the green, you go for it, you shortside yourself, and now you're even more pissed. So it's like, I think it comes down to just the confidence in your game. If you know that, okay, I'm, yeah, this was one bad hole out of the 72 holes, it's going to sting. You can't get that, you can't get those shots back, but at least let's get right on track on the next shot, and let's make a good swing and a good decision, and let's just get this round back on track. And then maybe on Sunday at the end, maybe you have a chance to win. And I mean, I just think back to when we played the WGC in where was it, in Florida, that one COVID year where Colin won concession. Yes. Is it concession?
Yeah.
And I made a quad on my last hole on Saturday. I think I was in like fourth or fifth place and made a quad on the last hole, and yeah, was way out of it. But then I played really nice on Saturday and even Sunday, and finished second. So it's like, you could easily just let that hole ruin your whole week. And that was that tournament. I did so well for so long, and then you make a couple bad decisions and you're out of it. But because I felt good with my game, I kept on pushing and just made a lot of birdies. And then on Sunday, I think I was tied for the lead there with a few holes to go. So it's just, it's hard to think that way in the moment, but when you look back on it, you're like, man, I had a good chance to win even with that quad. So it's like, you're never completely out of it if, you know, if you keep playing well and make good decisions.
The other thing I love about the way you approach golf, but also the way you approach life, you're always smiling. On the golf course, you seem to have a very, very positive attitude. You seem to be able to let things kind of not outwardly. Like, I've never seen you throw a club or break a club or kick your bag or anything like that. I know that bad shots affect you, but the mental, the attitude that you have on the golf course, have you always had that? Because you always seem to be one that, you're always smiling on the driving range. You're always smiling after the rounds. It doesn't really, regardless of what you shoot, you always seem outwardly to be in a good mood. And I think the thing I love most about your attitude on the golf course is when you make bad swings, you laugh a lot. You're kind of like, this is a bad shot. You're human and stuff. Have you always been able to kind of have that type of attitude on the golf course?
Well, I'd say I probably got you fooled a little bit, but... Well, it's just like,
yeah, but I think that's a huge thing, Vic, to, yeah, you do, no, have people fooled so that, listen, if you're playing with somebody and you're coming down the stretch and you can see them getting more and more agitated, and you can see, you know, we've all seen, you know, last week was, you know, a great example in LA. At one point, right around that, when the leaders made the tour, there were five guys tied for the lead, right? Everybody was all of a sudden tied for the lead. And three holes later, three of the guys that were tied for the lead look like they're shooting 90 and they're the heads down and they're throwing clubs and stuff like that. And so I think it's a positive that outwardly your opponents don't see that you're getting down on yourself.
Yeah. I think it just, I guess I'm not super proud of how I've reacted in kind of recent tournaments, because my swing hasn't kind of been where I wanted. And it's so frustrating for me, because like, competing and playing and winning, that's fun. But I think it's more fun actually hitting the shots that I want to, just the mastery of the game itself. And it pisses me off when I try to hit a certain shot and I'm not accomplishing it. So that really just makes me mad. So I could be really mad at home practicing, just out on the golf course, and if I'm trying to hit a certain shot and I can't hit it, that just irks me. So that will get me really, really mad. And sometimes I'm in that situation out on the tournament, and I'll react that way. I'll react in a poor way. But I think it's easier for me to, like, and I've told multiple people to explain kind of how my mind works, and I know it doesn't maybe make that much sense, but when I'm in a tournament, obviously the score is what matters, but I would much rather shoot 73 and make two double bogeys, and the two double bogeys that I made were perfect swings. It was the shot that I wanted to hit, but it was the wrong club, where I got a bad bounce, it went over the green, or hit a sprinkler head and went OB, or whatever it might be. I'd rather take the 73 or 74 doing that than shooting 69 and not hit a single good shot and just really hacked it around, because that doesn't give me a lot of confidence. Even
you know,
though
you know the 69 still counts, right?
It does.
At the end of the week.
I know.
You still got you even if you shoot 69 and the ball strike is bad, Vic, you still get to take the score.
I know, but it's like that's just kind of how my mind works.
That's why you're good.
Yeah. So then when I'm playing well and I make a mistake, yeah, it pisses me off in the moment because I know how valuable those shots are. But at the same time, I can look back and, okay, that was just a bad club. I misjudged the wind or whatever it might be. It was just a bad swing at the wrong time. But I know that my fundamentals and what I'm doing right now is good, and I'm probably going to play good tomorrow because I know the fundamentals are good. But it's like, yeah, I shot, even LA last week, I finished 19th, and I shot under par every single round, but it wasn't good. Like, I didn't hit it very good. So that doesn't give me a lot of confidence. Now, I'll turn that into a positive thing that, okay, I hit it awful the whole week. I didn't play well at all, but I still finished top 20 at a hard golf course among some of the best players in the world. So I'll turn that into a positive, but I'm not going to trick myself into thinking, oh, I'm playing well, it's all good. No, I got to get home and get back to work.
Second at the PGA last year, you were in the last group with Brooks. Majors, obviously, when you get to a stage that you're at, you've been on a winning Ryder Cup team, you've won the FedEx, you've won PGA Tour events, you've won on the DP World Tour, you've won on iconic golf courses, you won in Dubai, you won Jack's Place. What'd you learn from the final round of Sunday at Oak Hill? Because you didn't play, that's one of those rounds. You didn't go out and shoot 75, 77 and lose it. You shot in the 60s. Didn't get it done. Did you learn anything that day from that experience?
Yeah, that's actually a good segue as to what I was talking about
before.
Because I was really proud of myself how I handled going up against now a five-time major champion, Brooks. And on Sunday, you know, he's got the intimidation factor. And
what is the intimidation factor that he has? The fact that he's won four majors?
Yeah, he's been in that situation before, and he doesn't really back out. You know, he's gonna show up and play well. Obviously, his demeanor, he's a big guy, doesn't talk too much. Yeah. He's not gonna be out
hits
there
it miles.
Yeah, hits it far. So you just like, you know that he's not gonna.
He's a bully on the golf course. So the way he plays golf is very much he's going to beat the golf course down. Like you said, he doesn't talk to anybody.
Yeah. And I respect that. I think that's cool. And I really enjoy just going up against him and playing against him. And I knew that my game's good enough to beat him. And I really felt like I did a good job. Now the bunker situation on 16, that's one of those things where, okay, I made a double bogey there, but yeah, it wasn't the best drive, but it was just one of those moments. It was the wrong shot at the wrong time, and I got
what were you
bad
seeing?
Break.
So in that moment, give me the yardage that you had.
Oh, I don't remember all the specifics. But
you probably, guys, I mean, that's probably in the
I think it was 160 yards.
Yeah.
It was on the downslope.
You
in
work
the bunker.
In meters, right?
Yeah. So 145 meters, I'd say.
145 meters. Yeah. Did it look like you could clear the lip? And what club were you in between clubs, or did the first club you pulled in that situation, you went, okay, this is the one?
Yeah. It might have been closer to 165 because I was in between a 9 and an 8.
Okay.
But I figured the pin's slightly further back. I'm just going to hit the 9, keep it a little bit short. And that's obviously going to help me clear the lip. Now it's on a downslope. The lie wasn't all that great. So my thoughts are, okay, well, I got to make sure I hit the ball first. So I just guarantee contact or else the nine is just not going to get there.
It's not going to get there.
And obviously it's on the downslope. So when I catch ball first, I catch it slightly thin and it just doesn't come out. And, you know, that happens. Most of the time it either hits the lip of the bunker
and comes out
or worst case, it stays in the bunker. But now hopefully I have a better lie, but it ended up being plugged in there and now I got to take an unplayable and now I still got a layup from there. So it was just a bad break. And yeah, you don't like
hindsight. Do you take wedge and just chip it up?
No. It was just,
so if you had it to do over again, you choose the same club, which I love the fact that it's always easy to second guess it, right?
Yeah.
It's always easy to go this, that, but I love the fact that you're saying, hey, I'd do it again, and I'd just execute better.
Yeah. And, I mean, I just still think back to how I played before that. Now, I wouldn't say if I would have made a couple more putts, like Brooks had his putter going really nicely.
The putt he made on 13 for par from 12 feet was huge.
It was big.
Down the hill on a par 5, the last thing you want to do is make bogey there, going into the drivable par 4 on the next one.
Yeah.
When you play a golf course like that, Vic, I mean, that's a hard kind of old school Northeast golf course. You know the golf course isn't going to give you a lot. So when you're going out on a Sunday in the last group, in a major, on a hard golf course like that, the mindset is, okay, these are the holes that I feel like I have to take advantage of. These are the holes or the stretch of holes where, hey, if I can just get through these with pars, hang on.
Yeah.
Is that what you're thinking?
Kind of, but it's also because when you don't make birdie on the easier holes out there, that could kind of stress you out a little bit. And that's where I think the confidence comes in with your ball striking that, okay, I can hit the shots. And even on the hardest holes on the golf course, you can hit two nice shots and give yourself a birdie look and maybe sneak in a birdie where most guys are making bogeys. And that's when you can really, that's how you're going to win tournaments. You know, you're not going to do that consistently, but you make birdie on the easier holes and make a lot of pars on the tougher ones. That's kind of how you want it to set up. But if you want to separate yourself and win the major championships, sometimes you have to birdie the hard holes as well. Yeah. And that entails, you know, having a 4-iron into par 3.
Having to stand up and hit.
And just stuff it.
I think every tournament, especially the bigger the tournament, the bigger the golf course, there's always that moment to where, if you're watching, but for you, for us, for all of us on the inner workings of it, you're like, okay, you just got to stand up and hit a good shot here. I had Matthew Bavon on the pod.
Okay.
And he was talking about that at Torrey Pines. You go to Torrey, there's no bailout there. You know that if you want to win the golf tournament, you got to stand up and you just got to hit really good shots. And really good shots, like you said, sometimes a really good shot is a 4-iron from, you know, over 200 yards to 25, 30 feet. And that's a good shot. It's not the 7-iron to 3 feet and everybody claps. Sometimes the great shots when you win these tournaments are the ones that nobody really, other than the people that you were playing with or the people that are watching, that are playing, that are going, he won the tournament by making par there, and everybody thinks he won the tournament by the two birdies that you made. Yeah. You're like, no, it was standing up, hitting a really good drive here.
Yeah,
really get. You had a chance, 7th at the Masters last year. Obviously, that's the first major of the year. It's at the same golf course every year. What do you like about Augusta as a course, and how do you think Augusta plays well for your guys? Because I think it's a really good golf course for the way that you play. Yep. With as high as you can hit the golf ball, with as high as you can hit your irons, I just think Augusta is one of those places where you're going to be one of those players, Vic, that's always going to be a guy that is a threat around that golf course.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. And
I mean, you were low am there as an amateur when you were the USAM champion. So obviously, I also think it's the type of golf course, if you play well there as an amateur and you turn pro and you know that you're going to continue to play there, you've got to say, okay, I got here and I really didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And my game when I came here in 2018 was much rawer than it is now. So going into the first major of the year, when you get to Augusta, what do you like about that golf course? And what do you think, having played there and having had a top 10 last year, what do you feel like you have to do well there for the week?
Yeah, I just think it's really cool. Every time I show up there, you learn something new. There's so many slopes and undulations and where to miss it, where not to miss it. You always learn something, and I think that's really cool. I think that's why it's so hard for first-timers out there to do really, really well. Because there's so much experience that that leads to a huge advantage. And it is really, really tough, especially certain pin locations and when the conditions, if there's wind around there, it becomes very, very difficult. But it's one of those places you don't have to be perfect. It's really hard, but you don't have to be perfect if you know where to miss it.
And I think so many players there, Vic, they do the Jedi mind trick on themselves there because they're trying to be so perfect that because you know that to win around there, it does take historically some element of perfection or knowledge or something like that. But I think what I'm hearing you say is sometimes you can get into trying to be so perfect, trying to, you know, everybody knows, you know, the seventh green, there's places where they put that pin where you've got a five yard square to land it to get it close.
Yeah.
When they put that pin back right on six, you know, to get it close there, there's a very small landing spot. But you're saying that maybe sometimes you try and become too perfect and you don't hit the right shot that you need to hit, and you didn't maybe need to be that perfect around Augusta.
That was kind of the week. Joe Mayo was out there watching me, and he had watched me play all the tournaments that I played up to that point earlier in the year. And he kind of said in the middle of the week that there's something wrong. Like, the strategy is wrong. And that was kind of the impetus to us talking deeper to Eduardo and figuring some more stats out. And it showed in the aftermath that with seven irons and in, I was way too aggressive. And I was short-sighted myself over two times as much as a normal or the average iron player on tour, which I'm above average with my irons. So you would think I would short-side myself less, but I short-sided myself 2.5 times more, which that's hard to make up for. And especially at Masters or Augusta, it's very
difficult.
There's
just not a lot of places to... There's no real stretches of that golf course other than the par fives where I would imagine as a player mentally, you're like, this is a birdie hole.
Yeah.
And once you get to the weekend, it feels like because of the weekend at Augusta, if you're kind of around the lead, I would imagine you feel like, okay, I got a birdie two, and then I've got a birdie 16, I've got a birdie 13, and I've got a birdie 8. Other than that, I'm basically just trying to hang on.
Yeah.
But you are going to get days, Vic, where the weather's good, where maybe it's a little bit soft, and there is going to be that player that goes out under really good conditions and shoots 6 under, 7 under.
Yeah.
But I think that golf course more than any, because it's the same, it mind tricks you into going, because you know where all the problems are.
Yeah.
You've seen where everybody, you know, I mean, 19, you know, you get three players in a row, rinse it in the water and all make double bogey. And Tiger hits it left of the green, hits it 20 feet and gets out.
So
do you think sometimes Augusta, the way it's designed and the design of it, I mean, Alistair McKenzie, the great designer, you know what his job was in the military, right?
No, I don't.
Camouflage.
Okay.
He was a camouflage expert in the military. Somebody told me that once when I was living in Scotland. They're like, he was an expert in camouflage. So if you look at most Alistair McKenzie, if you go to the first hole at Augusta and stand and look back, you can never see any of the bunkers.
Yeah.
So when you're on the green and look back, you can't see where any of the bunkers are because of the way they're designed. So does Augusta mentally get in your head because you're like, okay, I'm not supposed to be under par because the golf course is so hard. If you make the turn in 3-4 under and you get a good look at 10, you're like, okay, I can go to 4 or 5 under here, but I'm not supposed to be 4 or 5 under because the golf course is so hard.
Not so much that way, but it's more like, okay, just for example, the first round last year, I was 7 under par 313, and I ended up shooting 7 under par that first round. But I was doing things like number 9, the pin was all the way left, back left, and I'm on a slope that's, you know, the ball's below my feet. And I also like to hit a cut. Shea's telling me it was a full 9-iron. Shea's like, I'll just hit it 30 feet right of the pin. And I'm just like, no, I got this one. I hit a cut off the bunker, land it left of the pin, and hit it to like 2 feet. And Shea's just laughing because like it was nice. So I got to 500 par after nine.
But my point that
it's stupid.
Nobody is thinking from that lie, ball below your feet, the back left pin, because you put it in that bunker.
Yeah. And it's bogey every time.
You could still be in there.
Yeah.
And then you're in that bunker and you're trying to figure out, okay, if I can get this inside of 15, 20 feet, this is an unbelievable shot.
Yeah.
But that's, I know Shea's walking to the green looking at you going, and all of the veterans that would watch you hit that shot would just go,
yeah.
No. But is that a situation to where the percentages, your caddy sent, but you just see the shot?
Yeah. I mean, that was like, that was kind of the impetus to that changing of strategy. Cause I think it's like,
it's borderline reckless.
It's way beyond reckless. Cause I played with Tiger that round and I remember I was
fighting. I know he's looking at you going, just put this thing 20 feet.
Yeah.
Cause there's never been a player and you've gotten to play with him a lot. And one of the other things that I wanted to ask you, I marvel at this. And I asked Shea about this as well after the Ryder Cup, very similar to Tiger. I've never seen a player hit the ball pin high or past the pin as much as you do. For as an elite of a player as you are, Tiger always, you played a lot. The guy dumps at the pin high all the time, and it's an art form. But I noticed it a lot because I was doing TV at the Ryder Cup. You hit it pin high or 1 or 2 yards past the pin so many times during the course of a round. Is that by design? Is that something that you're even conscious of?
I'd say when I play my best golf with my irons, I have, like, because on the range, you always just hit a full swing, just a normal full swing. But on the course, you never have a perfect number. You always got to take a little bit off or hit it slightly harder. And when I play my best golf, I have taken more club, unless it's like a short pin and you got to stop the ball quickly. I take more club and hit like a 3/4 punch shot, but it has enough spin on the ball to where it just launches slightly lower, it spins up in the air, and I just have a lot of control with it that way. So to those back pins, I can hit like a low 6-iron that lands 25 feet short of it, skips up and just releases slightly instead of, oh, I got to hit a perfect 7-iron to maybe get it within 20 feet, and then the bad swing, or when it comes up, it's probably 30, 40 feet short, and you're just always lag putting from there. So that's kind of a place where I would just take slightly more club, and I would just be very comfortable with those 3/4 shots, and you can squeeze that into a lot of corners on the green instead of just, okay, well, I don't have a perfect number, so I'm just going to hit the full swing middle of the green. You kind of handcuff yourself that way.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Tiger, you've won the Hero twice. He's gotten to give you the trophy. That's the Tiger. But I would imagine out of all the places, if you're going to get paired with Tiger Woods, if you get paired with Tiger at Augusta, it's got to be really hard during the round to not be trying to like figure out, okay, what's he doing? I mean, what's the strategy here? Because, I mean, he is such a savant genius. He's won so many times around that golf course. Is it hard when you're playing with Tiger at Augusta to not watch him and not watch what he's doing?
I'd say now I've only played with him 2 times, but when I played with him there, obviously it was really cool. It was a cool place to play with him at, but I'm still a competitor and he's playing against me, so I'm going to try to beat him. And so I don't pay too much attention, and I didn't want to be the guy that goes up and just like, oh, yeah, that's I'm not going
to
do that.
Tony tried to talk. You've heard that story, right?
I haven't.
So Tony played a bunch of practice rounds with him and played a lot of rounds with him. And, you know, I mean, obviously they're boys and stuff, but 19 T-Dubs in the last group with chance to win. And Tony's trying to talk to him through a couple rounds. And I've got to be honest with you. He's lucky. Tony's lucky that Stevie wasn't on the back, because Stevie would have ran him out earlier.
Yeah.
But the difference between all of the sudden Tiger, when he's in the hunt, like you said, you're a competitor, so you're not going to fanboy and watch whatever. I mean, he is the ultimate. I mean, he's not going to watch what anybody else is doing. And you were born in the year that he won the Masters for the first time in 97. Was he your idol growing up? I mean, everybody, I think, of your age group idolizes him, but was he kind of the catalyst as to one of the reasons why you chose golf as a path for basically your entire life?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Did he get play in Norway? I mean, Norway, not a huge golf country.
No.
I mean, Henrik Bjørnstad, one of the all-time best on the European Tour, Beartown, love him. If you haven't watched, who's the other guy that does the commentary when you're winning golf tournaments?
Per Haugstrand.
I mean, there should be an alternative live feed every time you play competitive golf with the two Norwegian commentators, because their enthusiasm for it. But was Tiger a big deal growing up in Norway?
Yeah. I mean, people in Norway didn't really watch golf too much. There's a few people that would watch Henrik Bjørnstad, as you mentioned, when he was playing a few years ago. And, you know, the people that played and knew, they knew. But I'd say most other people, they're like, oh, you play golf? I only know Tiger Woods. So everyone knew who Tiger Woods was. And I just remember in high school and even before that, I would just, when we had computers in class, I would just watch on YouTube just Tiger Woods highlight reels. And just getting like hairs on my back and just
standing
up. Can I tell you
something? As someone that watched that, I was lucky enough, you know, my dad started coaching him in 93. I took the video. You'll see some video of my dad with the straw hat on.
Yeah.
I took the video. I was running the video day. So I was
cool.
I was there that first day.
Yeah.
So you're of that generation that never really got to see him play.
Yeah.
You watch it on YouTube. I say this to everybody. You're it. I promise you, as good as you think it was so much better.
Yeah.
He was so much better than we remember now.
Yeah.
He just was amazing. Is it crazy to you to think now that when you go back to Norway, surely you must get recognized now as an athlete, as someone who is doing great things? When you were growing up, you told people what you did. You were playing golf and they're like, I don't know any golfers. I just know Tiger Woods. Now you are going to be someone that someone 13, 14 years old that wants to play golf is going to go, I know Victor Hovland. I mean, and are you getting, when you just got back, I know you went home over Christmas and over the holidays. Do you get recognized now?
Yeah, I'd say so. Especially if I go to a golf course. That's really cool. The pandemic helped people kind of get into golf a little bit more, because it was a sport you can be outside and still be social and have fun. But definitely seems to, like, us Norwegians as people, we're very patriotic when our countrymen do something good. Like Magnus Carlsen, when he beats everyone in chess, everyone just starts playing chess. And I remember Husovd, he was in Tour de France, and then suddenly everyone starts cycling. And so Norwegians are very much like that. And now it seems like, oh, now people that don't play golf, they watch golf because they want to support me or whoever it might be. So that's really cool that I can kind of play a part of inspiring other people from Norway, as I was inspired by Tiger and other guys when I watched them when I was younger.
Crazy times in golf in 2024, Vic. 2025, what would you like to see? I mean, you know, it seems like there's so much upheaval. LIV, SSG coming in for the tour now. Like a lot of players, I know the LIV guys made you an offer. You chose to stay. Some of your Ryder Cup teammates and Tyrrell Hatton and John Rahm chose to go. But for you as a player and you as a person and as a professional golfer in 2024, what direction would you like to see the game go in as a way to maybe try and change things from what it has been?
Yeah.
Because I think I've gotten to know you over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. I think you're a really bright thinker. You're smart. You're inquisitive. You're a curious person. Mm. You ask questions. That's one of the things I like talking to you, because you ask questions. Sometimes people don't really ask. So what are the questions you still have, and what would you like to see maybe this look like one day?
Yeah. I don't know. I like to ask questions because I don't know a whole lot myself. So if I ask more questions and I get more information, then I can make a better decision. Right. And I think that's the frustrating part from my standpoint, is that us as players, things haven't been very transparent for us. So it's hard for us to, when you're asking me a question here and I want to be truthful and give you a straight kind of answer.
You have all the facts and you don't know.
Yeah, so I just don't know. But I would like to see, obviously, the LIV is bringing in a lot of money to the sport, and there's a lot of competition, which I think is good. But it seems to have been a response from the PGA Tour side that, okay, it's just more talk about the money. And I think that's a little bit sad. Now, money is important, and everyone needs to get paid accordingly in a fair way. But I don't think that needs to be like the driving force behind this or the story every single week. It's like, not to dog on a tournament here or there, but like, you could put the price or the purse for John Deere to $6 million to first place, but I'd much rather win a memorial or a tournament like
because
that.
Because of the history and the golf course and
yeah.
Jack and
yeah.
something like that. Listen, I think that every player on tour wants to win a golf tournament on an iconic golf course. I mean, last week, DJ was up here over the weekend hitting some golf balls, and he's on his phone watching the early coverage of Riviera.
No way.
And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, it's my favorite golf course. He's like, I was so lucky to win there.
That's cool.
Love it. You know, he named his son River after Riviera. So it is a golf course.
No way.
Course.
Yeah. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Named after River. So DJ loves that golf course.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, he just loves it. And so, for you, winning at a place like Memorial, obviously your first win in Puerto Rico is huge. But when you win a tournament at Jack's Place, all the people that have won there before, it's an iconic PGA Tour golf course.
Yeah.
For you, it means something winning those type of tournaments and winning on those type of golf courses.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You're going to have those memories of winning that event, seeing kind of your name on that trophy and the history of
Jack
all the names.
Standing there when you walk off.
Man. That's pretty cool. Obviously, the paycheck is nice as well, but if that's what you're remembering by the end of the week, I'd kind of, that feels a little bit soulless, in my opinion. So, you know, it's, I don't know what the path forward is, to be honest. It's been a little sad, but I try not to think about it too much. It's a little comical, to be honest, to see what's going on in the game of golf, but I hope there's a resolution in the future, because at the end of the day, I just want to compete at the best golf courses, the best tournaments, against the best players, and it's as simple as that. However that's going to happen, I don't know, but that's what I would like to see.
I think there are supposed to be smarter people than us, Vic, trying to figure that out.
Yep.
Lastly, your love of death metal. where did it come from? That genre of music, the people like yourself that are big into death metal, you're big into death metal. I mean, it's big. And give me some bands that are your favorite. But when did you start listening to death metal?
Well, I've always been a Linkin Park kind of guy. So I liked rock, but I was too young to really know that, oh, this is rock or hard rock or alternative, whatever you want to call it. And my Swedish coach at the time, when I was kind of 12, 13 years old, because it was winter in Norway, snow everywhere, so we decided to take a road trip to Sweden for the weekend, and because we could practice there a little bit. And he's kind of an old school hard rocker, heavy metal guy. So Iron Maiden, Rammstein, and kind of those bigger bands, Guns N' Roses, all that stuff. So as he's playing that in the car, I'm thinking, this is pretty good. I like this stuff. And after the trip, I went home, just Google on YouTube or search on YouTube best metal songs. And the first thing that pops up is System of a Down, Chop Suey. And I start playing it. It's super melodic in the beginning. I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then they just start screaming. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, this is a lot. This is aggressive. And I listened to it. I didn't really like it. I turned it off. And then a couple days after, I came back to it. I listened to it again. And then I listened to it again. And then I just realized, okay, I kind of get it now. It just, something clicked to where I understood the message, or it just...
Some of those songs can be like quite melodic and stuff. Yeah. And then it turns into the, you know, the guitar and all the drums and that kind of...
Yeah. And then instead of being like, whoa, backing off and what is this? This is aggressive. I just kind of accepted it and understood it. And then from then on, it was just, okay, how extreme can I get?
So there's death metal, and then there's Scandinavian, Swedish, Norwegian death metal, which is like, I mean, that's like someone being, he's a scratch golfer, and then there's like a plus five. I mean, if we're going for death metal, I mean.
Yeah, well, I'm not like, because in Norway, we're very known for black metal, and I just haven't delved into that at all. That's not really my style, because what's cool, the more you get into metal as a genre is so big. You have so many subgenres within metal. And I've gravitated, like in Sweden, they have a lot of melodic death metal is what they call. And there's a lot of bands like In Flames, that's old school, and I just like their sound and their style. And then now in recent years, I've listened to a lot to a band called Vildjarta. And that's like...
Are they from...
They're from Sweden as well, but it's not like... I mean... They say that their genre is kind of thal. That's what they call. And it's just like they've kind of created their own genre because it's so out there. And I just think it's not something that I listen to all the time because it's pretty intense and it's just you kind of have to sit down and pay attention to it. But I think it's I just remember listening to the recent album they posted a couple years ago, and it had taken them over 10 years. From their first album to make the newest one. And I could just, as I'm listening to it, you can hear like a lot of what do they call it, Easter eggs. Okay. In this new album, like riffs and sounds and melodies that they had in the first album incorporated into the newer album. So it was just like, as I'm listening to it, the beats are awesome, or the riffs are awesome, and it's just the sound is great. And then you hear the old sounds that you've heard before into a new song. It was just, it was unbelievable. So ever since then, I've just kind of considered that band as my favorite band.
Do you go to shows?
I don't. I much prefer just put the headphones on and just be in my bedroom and just chilling out.
Lastly, Vic, goals for this year. You know, obviously coming off of a monster, I mean, there are years and then there are monster years. I mean, the way you played last year, you win the tournaments that you won, you win late in the FedEx and then win. I mean, it's hard to back that up, right? But obviously you're one of the players that every single major that's going to be played for the next 10 years, your name is going to be penciled in as one of the favorites. So what are the goals this year and how do you go about trying to back up, like I said, a breakthrough monster career year for you in really, you know, you've had a career year really before you're 30.
Yeah.
You haven't even been on tour 5 years now and you've had that monster like Jordan Spieth. Jordan Spieth had wins two majors. I mean, where do you go from there?
Yeah, I definitely would like to win a major and win a lot of tournaments, keep winning tournaments, but I'm not a guy that sets goals like that. I know what I need to work on in my golf swing or on the greens or in the short game, just or outside of golf. And I'd like to just keep improving on that, just get a little bit better all the time. And then, you know, I can't really... I mean, obviously, I'm in somewhat of a control, but I can't control if I'm gonna win that PGA at Oak Hill last year. It's one of those things that, at the end of the day, yes, I finished second, and it was brutal the way that I finished second. But I was very happy with the way that I played, how much I had improved in just a short span of time. And if I continue to do the right things and I see things improving, I'm gonna win tournaments and I'm gonna have good results. So that's kind of just how I think about it, just constantly trying to get a little bit better.
Well, I've been around professional golfing my whole life, and you know, rarely do we see a player like you that has not only all the tools that you have, but I think the way that you think and the way that your brain works and kind of your approach to golf, I just think is so refreshing, and it's been really fun to watch all the success you've had. And I will be shocked in 2-3 years now if you don't have multiple major championships because
no
your
pressure.
Game, no, but Vic, your game is so good, and you are such a kind of breath of fresh air to competitive golf. Like I said, the way you're always smiling, but the game that you have is just, it is so, so fun to watch. And I just think the sky's the limit for you, man. I think if you're not, even though the world rankings are kind of a little bit weird now, but I don't see any reason why you're not number one in the world in the next 3 years, because that's how good you are.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
that. It's a pleasure to watch, and I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk to us.
Thanks for the chat, Claude.
So that was Victor Hovland, and it's easily one of my favorite pods. Like I said, I'm a fanboy, right? I mean, I was fanboying the entire time I'm talking to Vic, because I really like him as a person. I really like him as a player, and I love his game, and I love his approach, the way he plays golf. I love the fact that, you know, we talked about how the fact that he was a terrible chipper when he came out on tour, and, you know, he fixed that. And in a lot of ways, I think Vic is kind of fearless. He's a fun guy. He's joined my club, the Floridian. So I get to kind of get to talk to him when he's home and get to kind of watch him work and watch him hit balls and watch how he goes about doing things. And I'm a fan. So to be able to sit down and talk to him was a really, really cool experience for me. Like I said at the top of the show, 2 million downloads. That is just, it's mind-boggling to me. And I'm incredibly humbled that everyone listens on a weekly basis, and we're going to continue to try and get you more guests. But the main thing we're going to try and get you to do is help you with your game, so that when you go out and play, you've got things you can work on, ideas, ways to play golf. And hopefully by listening to the podcast, you take away something, not only from something that I've said or one of the players or the other coaches or the other guests we've had on, that can maybe help you shoot lower scores and enjoy your golf more. So thank everybody for listening. Son of a Butch comes to you every Wednesday. We will see you next week.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.